I have you in Luke chapter 17, so if you'd like to join with me there, that would be great. I will reiterate the verses that we read last week and then just bring some thoughts, hopefully, that are apropos to this. Jesus said to his disciples, "Things that cause people to sin are bound to come, but woe to that person through whom they come. It would be better for him to be thrown into the sea with a millstone tied around his neck than for him to cause one of these little ones to sin. So watch yourselves." Maybe I just should sit back here again just to remind you, that's typically what a millstone looked like. That one is particularly well carved. It's almost perfectly circular. But again, if you remember, an animal or a slave would move around the pole many, many times, and you'd put the things that you want to crush in there. Jesus was ultimately saying, this would be better for this to be hung around your neck and you'd be thrown into the sea. Probably not unlike what some of us would picture as some organized crime might do to an individual that they want to make disappear. Really strong language, though, on Christ's part, because he wants to remind us, and when I say us, I want to be careful, because, again, I want to reiterate, Jesus is not trying to condemn somebody who makes a mistake. So if you have ever in your Christian walk said, "Oh my goodness, I made a mistake, and maybe I caused somebody to stumble," this is not your verse. I want you to be very clear about that. This is a verse geared to teachers. Those people within the Christian life who actually influence others. And when the teacher's heart is impure, in other words, when the teacher desires some ulterior motive for teaching, be it power, control, be it a messianic complex, you know, "I have to fix everybody and I'm going to fix you the way that you need to be fixed because I'm going to fix you in my image." Those kind of things, Christ says, be careful about. Because ultimately, if they lead a people to sin, you're in trouble. And so over in James chapter 3, where there's an admonition, don't everybody desire to be teachers? Don't you know that teachers are held to a higher state? They're held to a higher account. In our culture today, we don't like that concept so much. We don't like the idea that if you're in a place of influence and power, that you are actually judged, if I could use that terminology, but it's true, you're judged more harshly, you're judged more carefully, you're in the spotlight. And that's the reality of it. It's no different in these verses. So, watch yourselves is the command here. Be very, very strong on this. He then goes on and he says this: "If your brother sins, rebuke him. And if he repents, forgive him. If he sins against you seven times in a day and seven times comes back to you and says, 'I repent,' forgive him." Very difficult verses for us to deal with. And I wanted to teach on these verses today in light of some business material that I've gone through recently. I do enjoy reading leadership books from time to time. I just find them to be helpful for me just to keep my mind and thoughts sort of in a good place. And it's actually intriguing to me the number of business books that I read that have Christian principles built into them. Now, I don't know if that just means that there's businessmen out there who are in places of influence that are simply Christian, or it means that the principles that Christ institutes in life happen to also be good business principles. Probably a little bit of both. And I do want you to hear that, because this is something that at our Bible college, I'm attempting to build into every student. See, not every student is going to come to Bible college and be a pastor. But I do believe that a year or two of Bible college will build a foundation, an ethical foundation, by which you can be the best business person possible. Because I think the principles that Christ puts into place in our lives in general make our businesses work as best as possible. So there was a book that came out a couple of years ago by Granny called Crucial Conversations. This book is so profound that we're actually working through it at Horizon as a faculty and staff right now. That's how important it is. And Crucial Conversations have this at their root. There are times in life, in our relationships, in which we have to eyeball somebody and enter into a conversation that we don't want to have because it's hard. It's difficult. It's crucial because there's two different opinions in it. It's crucial because there's going to be strong emotions in it. And it's crucial because there's high stakes. And in the business world, the high stakes are whether or not your business survives. So the top business organizations in the world know how to have crucial conversations. When there's a problem, You don't bury it. You don't sweep it under the carpet. You deal with it. And so in sort of these three, if you will, sides of the pyramid come difficult conversations. Jesus is talking about a difficult conversation. When your brother sins against you, bury it. Right? Is that what he says? Why not? Why don't we just turn the other cheek and bury it? Yeah. No. It's a strong word to us, and it can be a strong word, but the rebuke here has at its mind to show somebody that they have somehow, some way, done something against you that's broken the relationship. The rebuke means to point that out, to say, hey, there's this problem, there's this difficulty, there's this breakage between us, and we need to deal with it. And the reason that there's a breakage between us is because there is this implied, you have sinned against me. So it's no different than us sinning against the Lord.
But why wouldn't he approach that person?
Actually, they're all tied into this very word of rebuke.
Right, but rebuke sounds very harsh.
It sounds hard to our ears because in the English it is harsh. We tend to view that word as if somebody's coming to crack a whip over our heads. The problem, of course, is that the Lord uses exactly the same word when he deals with us. He can rebuke us. But it doesn't mean that he's coming with this harsh stick, necessarily. But he is coming to say there's a problem between us, and we need to deal with it. So I agree with you that in our English, the context is quite strong. But I would suggest to you that it's not this harshness that we want to carry with it. It's the recognition that something precious is broken. We need to get it repaired. But here's the thing. If your brother rebukes you... If your brother sins, rebuke him. What's interesting to me about this, and we often say that, well, if you've sinned against me, then it's your responsibility to come to me. It's ironic here that Jesus seldom puts the responsibility solely on the person who does the sinning. So, if you remember over in the Beatitudes, when you are praying, if you remember that your brother has aught, the King James says, against you, what are you supposed to do? Yeah, leave your gift at the altar and go to him, try to make it right, and then come back. So, again, it's that picture not necessarily of saying, well, I'm going to wait for the guilty party to come and solve this because they created the problem, is when I recognize there's a problem, the Lord is pressing me to go deal with it. Now, I'd love to tell you that when you press a problem, it always goes away. Sometimes when you press a problem, it gets worse. But you've done your part. And once you've done your part, I've done my part. Now the Lord is free to do his part. And that's the brilliant thing here that I think I want us to remember. So, crucial conversation. Somebody has offended you. Somebody has hurt you. Somebody has sinned against you. He calls us to actually try, at least within our own energies, to the best that we can, to make the problem or to make the situation right. So there's that first thought. So, crucial conversations. We can tend to avoid them. If we avoid them, we're going to end up bottling it and becoming bitter. We can try to handle them, but maybe not handle them well. We can get angry, we can get upset, we can blow our tops, we can use words that we wish we never would have used. And ultimately, that produces bad results. Or we can face crucial conversations and handle them well. And I want to talk about what it means then to handle them well. So very briefly, if you remember last time we got together, I ended off with this. I had mentioned why these kinds of conversations are difficult for us. I mentioned that when you're in the midst of a difficult conversation, a crucial conversation, your biology sometimes takes over. Do you know what I mean when I say that? Hormones are chemicals. Chemicals affect our emotions. It's interesting, as I teach in a book also called Emotional Intelligence, sort of the flip side to your intelligence quotient, there's an emotional quotient. And one of the things that they point out in the material is that when thoughts are first injected into our brains, they pass through our senses. then they pass through the center of our brain where our emotional components exist. And then from there, they seem to flow to the front of the brain where our intellectual components exist. And what they were trying to point out is literally all of the stimuli that come into our lives pass first through our emotional centers before they get to our intellect. Now, that passage can take microseconds, milliseconds, or seconds. But the reality is that we will oftentimes react emotionally before the brain kicks into gear. And so ironically enough, when trying to deal with emotional issues, the very first thing that they try to teach you is to breathe and to count. So somebody comes to you and says, "You offended me." The first thing that they're going to try to teach you is breathe, a couple of big breaths, get oxygen going to the brain, and then to count 3 or 5 seconds. Wait, pause. Give yourself that opportunity to, instead of just, "I'm going to thump you," to then begin to think a little bit. And it's actually amazing that if we can hold back speaking for just a couple of seconds, it makes coming into the conversation and carrying the conversation forward much, much easier. So biology has something to do with this. The second thing that gets us all the time is when somebody comes up to us and said, "We got to talk," we're caught off guard. And because we're caught off guard, we want to react. What would be the answer to not getting caught off guard? If I were to ask you as a Christian, what do you do to prepare yourself for difficult times? How would you answer? Yeah, that's where I want to start, because I think that's the key. My morning devotions, your evening devotions, whenever you do your devotions, are times to and again, I'm constantly doing this. "Father, would you prepare me for the struggles that you know I'm going to face today?" I mean, I have no problem, and maybe it's just overly spiritual of me, but I have no problem asking the Lord for the abilities that he would prepare me today for the things that I'm going to handle this afternoon, tonight, tomorrow. Because I don't know what those things are. But I do believe that the Lord has the capability of preparing us. And that doesn't just mean growing us as leaders or growing us in maturity. It means, "Lord, help me to be prepared for this afternoon, whatever it is I'm going to face." But it's interesting that you point out is if I have to have a crucial conversation with somebody, I'm oftentimes going to write out, what are my goals? What do I want to accomplish in this? And we're going to talk about that a lot more in just a few minutes, because I think that's sort of the key to everything. But having a game plan of knowing how I want to go forward in something. So if Carolyn has something that she wants to talk to me about, maybe it's something that's, you know, we got to deal with our son or our daughter, or you know, something going on in our lives. I have noticed this, that she will always come and sit down and said, "You know, we need to have a talk about this. Let's talk about it, you know, tonight at 8. And she's very specific about this. So I have time to prepare my own self for it. Then we're going to sit down and we know we got to have this more serious conversation. This is not fluffy stuff. And then she will always pull out her list. So these are my thoughts. This is what I was thinking. And then away we go. And we have a great conversation that way. Incredible value in not being caught off guard. And then, of course, the third thing that makes crucial conversations hard is confusion. When you're in the midst of a battle, it's sometimes really difficult to think on your feet. And there has, again, in my relationships, there's times where I simply have to say to somebody, "Hey, our conversation's not going forward anymore. We need to stop. Let's break for an hour. Let's think about this. Let me give it some time to process in my own head. And let's come back and talk about it some more." And then finally, we talked briefly about what I just called here self-defeating behavior. It's saying the wrong thing at the wrong time to make situations worse. So these are some of the things that we'll struggle with. So if your brother sins, rebuke him. Now, ultimately, what the verse is driving at is to come together to point out there is this break in the relationship. You've perceived that somebody has done something wrong against you, and you need to deal with it. We need to deal with it together. That's the picture.
How many times do you have to do that?
According to the scriptures, as often as the two people together, I think this is the key, as often as the two people together believe that they're coming together to do this. So if somebody comes to me, let me just paraphrase what Jesus said. If somebody comes to me seven times in the same day, I know that's this huge obtuse thing, right? It makes no sense to us. But if they're truly coming to say, you know, I keep screwing up, then we keep having the conversation.
What if they don't?
This becomes a completely different situation. At that point in time, it's interesting. I had a long text chat with somebody last night on this very subject. So let's just pretend there's person A and person B, and there's this sin. Person B has done something bad to person A. Person A comes and says, "You've done something bad to me. There's a rift in the relationship. We need to heal with." So a couple of possibilities. Person B could say, "Blow away. I don't go. Forget it." And just turn around and walk away. Person A's responsibility now is to do what? Is it to chase person B? No. What's person A responsibility to the Lord? Okay, so right off the bat, it's prayer. We pray for our enemies who despitefully use us, right? That's the first command. The second command is, any idea, any thought? Pardon me? Forgiveness. Yeah, but I want to be careful about what I say about forgiveness, because that's where we're going to ultimately be leading here. We sometimes have a very warped view of what forgiveness is. Forgiveness is transactional, meaning that when true forgiveness happens, it happens in two directions, and it builds relationship again. In other words, it establishes a new relationship or a renewed relationship that allows two people to walk together in community. Forgiveness, from God's point of view, doesn't always guarantee that two people are going to walk together in unity. What do I mean when I say that? Forgiveness at its root means this, that I give up my right to hurt you because you hurt me. That's forgiveness. I want to reiterate that again because it's got nothing at all to do with emotions, nothing. I give up my right to hurt you because you first hurt me. That's forgiveness. In other words, what I'm doing, when person B, who's hurt person A, when person A says, "I forgive you, person B," what they're not saying is that what person B did was okay. Because it's not okay. What they're not saying is that person A now has all these wonderful ooey-gooey lovey emotions. "Oh, I just love you, person B." That's not what they're saying, because it's foolishness. What they're saying is when person A forgives person B, that person A gives up their right to hurt them. I relinquish it, and I give that person to God. Then I pray for God's best to flow into that person's life so that they would be transformed. And when they are transformed, this relationship between A and B can be transformed and rebuilt. That's forgiveness. Forgiveness says, "I'm not going to be sarcastic towards you. I'm not going to keep this list of all the bad things you've done because I've given it to God." Forgiveness means I'm not going to write negative posts about you on Facebook. Forgiveness means that I'm not going to go tell everybody in the world how evil a person you are. I'm not going to hurt you. I'm not going to be silent towards you. I'm not going to be indifferent towards you. I'm not going to stick my nose up when you walk by and cross on the other side of this. I'm not going to do any of that stuff. But I am going to leave my heart open so that when God does do this work, I'm willing to reconcile with you. That's forgiveness. So let me just say it again. Forgiveness is not meaning I let you off the hook. It doesn't mean it doesn't matter what you did to me. That's masochistic and it's evil. It's wrong. But what it does mean is I'm not going to try to hurt you. I'm not going to try to retaliate. I'm going to give you to God. I'm going to desire God's best for you. And God's best for you is a transformed heart that heals the sin. And when the sin is healed, we can be reconciled. And when that happens, my heart is open to reconcile and rebuild the relationship. That's forgiveness. That's exactly what God does to us. If the motive of pressing charges is protection, if the motive for pressing charges is my betterment, yes. If the motive for pressing charges is I'm just going to fix your wagon, I'm going to make you suffer, no. That's not forgiveness at that point in time. So, yeah, absolutely. We talk about the concept of tough love. So let's say, for example, I got a couple parents who've got a child, and the child can't handle money. And every month, the child comes back to the parents. I need money. I'm going to starve. Okay, son, here's $100. Go. Oh, and then it happens again the next week. And then all of a sudden, oh, I need $500. At some point in time, the mother and the father say, I'm sorry. This is the last time. You come to me again, the answer will be no. So the son comes to them again. The answer is no. Doesn't mean they hate him. It doesn't mean that they've shunned him. They turned their back on him. It simply means I'm no longer going to enable your sin, son. You got to figure this out. It's a tough love. It's a boundaries issue.
Even if it causes pain.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not that you're doing it for the purpose of causing pain, but
you know it causes pain. But it isn't that exactly what God does to us. God puts us in some of the most difficult, challenging situations, and they do cause us pain. And I have no idea, I'd like to think that God lays down on his bed, although he probably doesn't have a bed, at night and says, oh man, I wish I didn't have to, cause all that pain, but that pain is redemptive. It's a requirement so that somehow, God says, I can get into their heart and transform them. And that's why C.S. Lewis said that pain is God's megaphone. He shouts to us in our pain. He whispers to us in our blessing. He shouts to us in our pain. Pain by itself is not an evil thing. It has a redemptive quality when the motive is good and pure. And so in God's sense, absolutely, the consequences of our sin can bear with us. So if you have a promiscuous individual who goes around and sleeps everywhere, they develop AIDS or some other sexually transmitted disease, can God forgive them? Absolutely. Does God forgive them? Absolutely. Will he wash away that illness? Maybe, maybe not. There are those consequences to our actions, certainly while we're in this kingdom. So anyway, coming back to you, Bonnie, on your question, how often? The issue is not necessarily here if he comes seven times in this, in a single day, but the issue is, can I set a boundary so that that person's sin can't affect me, but keep my heart open so that when God does do this work, I can reconcile with them. That's what he calls us, I think, to do. Don't have to look at their stuff. We can still be touched by their pain, right? And we can still be mechanisms that God can flow through. But I think the answer to what you're saying, and again, I can be perfectly honest with you, it's something that I struggle with too, is I want to fix everything. And it's the revelation that I don't fix anything, but if I can be a tool in God's hands, there's the balance that we have to find, that we have to strike, is how can I be a mechanism that God can use without believing somehow that it's all about me?
No, it doesn't.
Well, we have talked about the concept of judging here before, and again, let me just reiterate. We are, in the Christian church today, deriving our definition of what it means to judge something by the world's standards. And the world has completely misaligned what it means to judge. Because I can show you where Jesus says, judge righteous judgment. So there are places in Scripture that we are called, yes, called to ensure that our judgments are righteous. They're good. They're solid. Because, quite frankly, if you and I cannot discern good from evil, well, we're right back to the garden where God said, if you eat of the tree, you will have a knowledge of good and evil. But if I can paraphrase, you will not have the abilities to discern good and evil. And that's our problem. We know it exists. We can't figure out what's what. So we go all the way back to that point in time. So we do need to be able to say, at the end of the day, God says that there are some things that are good and righteous and holy, and there's some things that are not. So Paul would write, whatever things are good or true or pure or holy, if there be any virtue, think on these things. we should have the ability as Christians to discern what's good and what's not good. So ultimately, it is our call, and it's our passion, I think, within the body of Christ to stir each other on to good things. But you're right, we cannot own another person's sin, and I don't think it's healthy for us to believe that it's all because of our failings. It's not. We all make choices. Every one of us make choices.
How would you deal with someone who...
Okay, so I could, if I said that, I would ultimately, I think at that point in time, be in the wrong. Because ultimately, if somebody has come to me seeking forgiveness, then I should do my best. And again, what is forgiveness? Forgiveness means I'm giving up my right to hurt you, even if I was the one who originally hurt you, right? But, you know, so if I offended you and you came, no. If you offended me, and then you came and said, would you forgive me? If I said no, I would actually be investing in a new wound, a new offense by withholding that. Now, again, it doesn't mean that relationship is instantly restored. It doesn't mean that there is this feeling that I just love you now, brother. Come here, I'm going to give you. That's not forgiveness. That's relationship, but that's not forgiveness. Forgiveness is the start of that where we, you know, we can move down the road together. So at that point in time, there's a new offense, actually, that's being generated from the old offense. I can say, to the best of my abilities right now, that even in my most angry parts of my life, the times where I was emotionally as upset as I've ever been in my life, I can truly tell you that at the end of the day, I didn't want that person to hurt. Yeah, I can tell you that. Now, that's a lot of years of... quite frankly, a lot of pain that I've gone through. So I give you a case in point. As I told you in the past, I was engaged at one point in time, and there was a lot of bitterness in the family towards me, a lot. And I remember having to get down on my face before God and said, I feel this anger and rage and this desire to hurt. I don't want it. I just don't want it. I don't want that to be part of my character anymore. And I will never forget, I walked through about 2 weeks of falling down on my face, I don't know how many times a day, and saying, God, it's come back. I hate it. It's evil. I don't want to hurt anybody. It's just not in my character. I don't want it to be in my character. And when it rears its ugly head, I want it crucified. And to be really honest with you, for the early part of my Christian walk, that was probably my number one prayer request. Because I recognized in, especially at my young age back then, this was a cancer to me. This was killing me inside. I was walking around, and again, please remember that before I got saved, there was more anger in me than probably most any of you have ever seen. I mean, when I tell you I would go into bathrooms and I would bash my heads into those metal wall dividers until they bled, that was me. That's how much rage I held inside. I was the classic definition of passive aggressive. I was dead silent on the outside, but man, on the inside, I was a volcano. I really, truly do not know how I survived that period of my life. But it was something that I begged the Lord. I wanted that thing crucified in me. So, you know, fast forward, you know, 3 decades later, where am I today? I don't have a lot of angry conversations anymore. There are times when I'm driving down the road and somebody cuts me off that I feel all of those old emotions rising up in me again. And I want to spit venom. I really do. And I feel, I don't know if it's going to sound stupid, but I actually feel that language and that vitriol rising up. And it's like a machine gun. So I'm going to pull up the song side of you and I'm going to let you have it. And at that point in time, I got to come back to God again and said, Father, here it is. It's that ugly old nature which you crucified in me again. And then I come to motive, which again, we'll talk about in just a second. And I find at this point in my Christian walk, when I think about motive, for whatever reason, the desire to cause pain just isn't there anymore. I can honestly tell you that through miraculous, I'll call it miraculous process, that part of me is different than it was. So I do believe that that is something that we can strive for. I don't know anybody that's there. I don't know anybody that's perfect. But I think we can actually see in our lives transformation. So, it's...
So, I still don't understand. So, if someone really hurt you at the time and says, oh, please forgive me, and you can say, yes, I forgive you, even though I hate your guts right now?
I can tell... Okay, and what does forgiveness mean? I can have anger towards a person and still forgive them, yes. Because forgiveness has nothing to do with feeling. It has nothing to do with emotion. It has everything to do with my will to give up hurting that person. Absolutely. No question about that. When we talk about this Matthew passage where when you're in worship and you recognize your brother has ought against you, go try to make it right. There they're dealing with a situation in which the Spirit of God has just brought to your mind this new thing. Wow, this is a problem that I got to deal with. I had a prayer room. I built a prayer room in my last church for that exact purpose. It was the best room in the entire church building. And I carpeted it, and I drywalled it, and I painted it, and I put beautiful stuff in it. And the purpose of that room was, if you're in the middle of a worship service and you need to talk with somebody, or if you just need to get alone with God, there's your prayer room. It's right there in the sanctuary. You just walk over there, and you were in silence together. Because I really believe that. However, if at the end of the day I've recognized that I'm not capable of going and doing that, then I would absolutely bring it to God. But here's the thing. You're not coming to the Lord to say, Lord, change my emotions. You're coming to the Lord and saying, Lord, change my desire to hurt so that I can instead give this person to you. Emotions and relationship change because people are transformed. In other words, God doesn't expect you and me to have the same relationships with one another here that we would with people generally in the world. The relationships are of a different caliber. You're going to understand that. They just are. So the community that's formed in Christ is formed because of Christ. Because Christ has done this work in both of us. If I'm walking in a sinful state somehow, some way, that is absolutely going to affect the relationships I have with my culture, my Christian culture. You can understand that. That's how it is. So that's my prayer. God, take away my desire to hurt, to inject myself, to try to crack the whip so that person will be like me. That's my cry to God. So I'm not waiting for him to give me the love feeling. I'm waiting for him to take me to a place where I can literally turn that person over to God. Why? Because when God intervenes, they change. When they change, they're now in line with Christian community again, and I can start to build relationship with them. You have to forgive me, but I've seen this in pop Christian psychology all over the place. That you have to act it. No. You have to feel it and then act it. Somehow or another, I think that's wrong. So in other words, it's once I feel something, then I go act on my feelings. It's not the Christian way. The Christian way is that I refuse to act in a way that destroys a person, thereby allowing God the time to move in their heart. When he's moved in their heart, they're transformed, and now we can have better relationship again. That, I think, is the order that God calls for our lives. So, yeah, I believe that we can all walk in this. I really do. Well, I mean, our whole doctrines of forgiveness have to flow from how God treats us. So even in our worst sinful state, where we have completely maligned the name of the Lord, he waits for relationship to be restored. And he woos. And he puts us in situations that cause us to think. And ultimately, his goal is to woo us back to him. And I think that that's the heart that we want in ourselves. Let me move on here real quickly, because Maybe we can touch on some of your questions here in what I want to cover. So when you're going to have this kind of conversation, somebody sinned against you, somebody has got a problem with you, this is the key. At the end of the day, what's the real goal? So at your heart of hearts, at the bottom of who you are, somebody has hurt you. What's the real goal? What do you really want accomplished? What do I want for me? What do I want for the other person? What do I want for the relationship? So when somebody moves to silence, so you're in a conversation and they withdraw, they mask, or they start to avoid, or violence. Violence can look like controlling, labeling, verbally attacking. These are a sign that people don't feel safe. So learn to look for these silence or violence signs. And when crucial conversations turn ugly, it's interesting. According to this business model, when you're in a conversation with somebody and they either turn silent or they turn aggressive and angry, what it oftentimes means is that they do not feel safe to be able to share at their core what their problems are. I've been in situations like this where in the business world, you know that somebody's got something against you, or you know that they've burned you in a business meeting, and you go to chat with them about it, and immediately they clam up. They don't say anything. No problem. I didn't do that. Then you know that there's something in the conversation that's not right. No, but somebody's not feeling safe to speak really and truly what's in their heart. So brothers and sisters, at the end of the day, when I've got a difficult conversation within the body of Christ, this is my first question. What do I really want? Do I want to hurt somebody? Do I want them to suffer? Do I want them to be humiliated? Do I want everybody in the world to see how evil they are? Or do I really, truly, honestly want God to do his best in them so they'll be transformed and they won't have to be evil anymore? There is probably no bigger question when you have somebody that's hurt you or you're in this situation to ask yourselves than that one right there. And then the second thing is, what do that person perceive in you is your goal? In other words, you have to ask yourself, what's my goal? Broken relationship, that person's hurt me. What do I want that person to do? And then you have to ask yourself, how is that person perceiving me right now? Am I the enemy? Do they perceive me as a person trying to control them? Do they see me as a person who's trying to let them go and let God do that? What's the perception back and forth? Those to me are the two keys. In our passage, when your brother sins, rebuke him. If he repents, in other words, he understands your motive and he turns back to you, forgive. In other words, that point in time when you've sensed that this relationship now is working back and forth and it's proper and it's good, God says, let it go. Let that anger, that passion to fight back, to strike back, let it go. And again, he reiterates this 7 times a day stuff because we are to remain in this kind of in this heart. This comes out of the book, and I threw it out here, not because it's a godly principle, although I think it is, but it is something that I want to challenge you with. If there is somebody in your life that has hurt you deeply, I think there's so much value in trying to ask yourself, why did they do that? Why are they the way they are? Why are they fighting against you? Why are they belligerent? Why do they use bad language? So the book just says this, get curious. Do you think there's value in trying to understand the whys behind the person that's hurt you? Absolutely, you're absolutely right. Getting curious doesn't mean you'll have all the answers. But how often when we're in a conflict do we simply say, my way's the right way. I don't care what your story is. Do it. Get it right or else. In other words, this is barrier. And all the author is trying to suggest here, and you're absolutely right, this is not an end-all and be-all, this is not a fix-all, and it's not a guarantee of anything happening. But it simply means that you've thought about who this person is, what they're struggling with, why they're struggling with it. And maybe, just maybe, there can be a little bit of empathy that's built there. Don't know. But brothers and sisters, none of us are the way that we are without a history of who we are. And sometimes just knowing that history, if nothing else, will give you an opportunity to pray in a way that you never prayed before. But I do like this concept of getting curious. That's brilliant. Whatever I do, I just pushed a bad button. I'm going to shut them off, and I'm going to come back here again. I took just a couple of thoughts from a second business book here that I'm going to throw out at you in relationship to this. We talked about that again. You can choose courage, or you can choose comfort, but you can't have them both. These come from a different book that I read recently from Brené Brown called Rising Strong. And it just comes back to tie some of these things that we were together talking about. So these are just these quotes I chose from her book just to stimulate the conversation. If we put ourselves out there and we love with our whole hearts, we're going to experience heartbreak, true or false? So Paul Simon can write, as Simon Garfunkel, "I am a rock, I am an island, no one touches me." You could live that way if you want, but I don't think there's any value in a life like that. But the reality is that in Christian circles, we will have conflict. So as I was reading through Philippians again the other day with our kids, it's our devotional time right now, we ran across two ladies in the Philippian church in which Paul said, "Hey, ladies, please, work it out. Get it together. Try to figure out your difficulties. And church, come alongside them and help them figure it out, because it's important." But she does bring this point up, and I think this is a really important point. Second thing that she brings up is, when I hurt, I often tell myself a story about the situation, and my version of the story allows me to be the victim and the hero, and often ends up with me getting my just reward. Truth problem is that my version of the story is almost always a lie. Do you believe that statement? I mean, I do it. So I play the VCR in the brain, right? Rewind, play again. Every time I play the same story over in my mind, I become better. The other person becomes worse. And oftentimes, I want to be the hero. I'm going to rise up, and I'm going to be strong. I'm going to fix this situation. And that other person is going to suffer big time. And she's right. I think she's got a good handle on human thinking, the way that we work through these problems. When we don't have all the facts to a story, we don't have all the facts to a situation, we will oftentimes make up a story. I find that to be a brilliant piece of authoring, because, again, if I don't have the facts, if you don't come to your brother, if you don't speak, if you don't work through the crucial conversation, if you don't understand where they're coming from, if you're not open enough to hear back and forth, then you will make up a story about that person. We all do. The question then becomes, is that story true or not? And she would suggest that it's not. And then finally, this last, healing begins when I exhaust every comfortable way of solving my problem, finally giving into truth and owning my story. And I've added this, seeking God to intervene. Brené Brown did some interviewing of Ed Catmull, who runs Pixar organization. And if you've ever watched a Pixar movie, you know that Pixar is, they tell great stories. But Ed Catmull, as I read through his book, another leadership book called Creativity Inc., brought out an intriguing thing. He says, in every one of our stories, it works this way. We introduce the cast. We introduce the problem. The hero of the story has some character flaw or difficult thing that they have to work through. The middle of the story is always the character attempting to solve his or her problem in every comfortable way, easy way. And so ultimately, at the end of the second act, the character comes to the conclusion that they cannot fix their problem in any comfortable way. and they have to change. The third act is always the results of the change and the culmination of some new character trait that exists now in our hero. And whether it's Toy Story or Finding Nemo, I mean, you name the story, every Pixar movie has gone through that same transition. There's a scriptural principle here that I think is valuable. When your brother sins or has sinned against you, we can go through all the comfortable ways of trying to ease the pain, but it never gets to the root cause. So my encouragement to you, brothers and sisters, is to bring these issues before the Lord, to seek Him and His ability to allow us to let it go, to forgive, to stop hurting, and then to pray, God, help me to rebuild the relationship. He may ask you to do something hard, and it may not produce the fruit, but it also may produce the fruit. And if it does, you've gained your brother again. Thoughts on this before I move forward? These are some books, by the way, that I heartily recommend to you as supplemental reading if you're ever interested. They will challenge you. They challenge me. Maybe just a brief thought here on forgiveness. This is what I have found in life, in my 20-some-odd years of pastoral life. When I teach on forgiveness, these are the things that people bring to me more often than not, who I need to forgive. Ironically enough, my parents seem to almost top the list. So a lot of times we carry around in our hearts some issues dealing with our parents. We didn't like what they did, didn't like what they say. In some cases, we have a parent that is left. In some cases, we have a parent who has died, and yet we still can blame. But it is a challenge to me to make sure that, you know, in my own heart, if I ever have issues, that I have brought them to the Lord. And then again, it's usually a friend or acquaintance, usually somebody in the church. Number three on the list, church leaders. Pastors or youth pastors or board members or deacons that have done something that we didn't like. And then we carry that around deep in our hearts. Fourth, interestingly enough, is myself. I don't have to say it, but if Christ says, I forgive you, then we must find the abilities in our own lives to say, I forgive me. Forgive me. Because Christ says, be perfect, and yet He can find it in His heart to say, forgive him. The challenge then is, can I look at myself and say, hey, God forgave me. It's okay. I'm going to let this go. I'm going to move forward. And then I don't know if you've ever heard this one before or not, but number five on my list is sometimes as Christians, we have to forgive God. God is omnipotent. God is omniscient. God is allowing me to suffer. He could change the suffering in a heartbeat. He doesn't. And I get angry. So how do I manifest that angry? I'm not praying to you anymore. I'm not giving to the church anymore. I'm not going to hang around with Christians anymore. Brothers and sisters, maybe you find yourself there sometimes. God is not angry with you if you're there. But He does say, my child, I wait patiently, sovereignly wooing you, sovereignly drawing you. And He asks you, I believe that any Christian who has walked for any time with the Lord will wrestle with this sometimes. Because we don't understand, He does, and we know that. So I fully understand what you're saying. We have all been there. And again, the beauty of it is, here's Christ with arms wide open, saying, I'm waiting. So when it comes to forgiveness, brothers and sisters, I'm passionate about this subject. Here's my last thought on it. Forgiveness never means they're off the hook. It's just they're now on God's hook and not yours. That's where we want people to be. Enough said. My time is almost gone here. You may be sitting here saying to yourself, this is impossible. How can anybody do this? So were the apostles. In fact, the very next words were, Lord, increase our faith. In other words, how could you possibly expect us to live this? And he replies, if you had faith as small as a mustard seed, you can say to this mulberry tree, be uprooted and planted in the sea, and it'll obey you. He is not condemning their lack of faith. Please understand that. He's not saying, you guys are such a bunch of wimps, you got nothing. He's not saying that. What he's saying is that it's not the quantity of faith that counts. It's the quality of the faith that counts. All he's saying is, if you will believe me, if you will believe that I can do this, then your faith will grow as naturally as a tree grows. That's that picture. If you have faith as small as a mustard seed. You see, when you plant a seed in the ground, like my wife did a few weeks ago, we don't have to sit there and go, grow, grow, oh, grow. Because it's going to grow. Because the quality of a seed moves it from seed to maturation to fruit bearing. All he's saying here is if you'll trust me, if you'll trust me, the seed will grow. And the seed will produce the kind of fruit that allows you to take a tree, and there's many different authors' interpretations on the mulberry tree, right? Some say, well, it's a tree that's got really strong roots. Fair enough. I think every tree has pretty strong roots, but if this one has particularly strong roots, that's great. The ironic part here is, as he says, you could take this tree and it will be uprooted and planted in the sea. And there's some people that say, well, why is it being planted in the sea? Well, it's probably because trees don't normally grow in the sea. This is something that's extraordinary. It's very different. I'm not even going to try to build theology around mulberry or tree or sea. The point of the matter is, if you'll simply trust Christ to do what he said he's going to do, you're going to see the miraculous. I think that's all you got to draw out of this parable, is you're going to see the miraculous. He wraps it up here in this particular pericope by saying, when you see the miraculous, don't expect it's because only some people will see it. Everybody will see it because we're all servants. Look at what he says. Suppose one of you had a servant plowing and looking at the sheep. Would he say to the servant when he comes in from the field, hey, come along now and sit down to eat? So would the master say that? Probably not. Instead, he would say, prepare my supper, get yourself ready, wait on me. When I eat and drink, after that, you may eat and drink. Would he thank the servant because he did what he was told to do? So you also, when you've done everything you were told to do, you should say, we're unworthy servants. We've only done our duty. You may look at this and you may say, man, this is really brutal language for Jesus. What is he calling us all, a bunch of slaves? Well, in a sense, we are a bunch of slaves. That's fair enough. But the point of the parable is not to somehow demean us and say, you're just a bunch of nothings. You just go serve me. The point of the parable is to remind us that we're all on the same page. That we're all servants. That the miraculous that happens over with the Peter and the James and the Johns and all of them guys, the same miraculous power flows through you and me. The point of the matter is, don't look at somebody over there and say, they're somehow so much better than I am because God uses them. And he says, you are all servants. You all serve me together. So he's looking to make sure that leaders don't walk around saying to themselves, I'm so much better than the people that I lead. Could you imagine pastors walking around saying, look at me, I'm so good, I'm so powerful, I'm leading. Jesus says, you know something? You're all on the same level. You're all on the same territory. You're all serving the same Lord. Remember that. So if I could apply all of this teaching to this last parable, let me just say this. When God looks upon you and me, he doesn't say, I'm going to give you lots of good stuff and I'm going to give you lots of painful stuff. He equips us all to do what he's called us to do. And that's the beautiful part of this parable, is he's equipped us all to do what we have to do. There's no magic, there's no elevation in the body. We are all servants of the same Lord. Questions or thoughts on that? Exactly. Yeah, it is hard, but the beautiful part of that is, again, he reminds us that we're all on the same page, that we're all serving the same Lord. And I think in that I find some comfort. Want to ask one last question, because my time is gone, and I'm gonna answer the question with a video clip from one of my favorite teachers, that's Ravi. But at the end of all of this, is it possible for us to ask this question? Is God actually concerned about me? You know, there's a lot of this emphasis upon how we should act, but how does that play back to us? I want to share with you in closing this clip from Ravi Zacharias as he ministers on campus and is asked that very question. Father, at the end of this year, I want to thank you so much for my brothers and sisters and the journey that we've been able to take. And I know we're only partway through the book of Luke, but I know even in preparing this, I have been renewed in my own mind and heart and strength because you speak so deeply. I can pray, Father, that my brothers and sisters would truly too be somehow, some way touched and renewed by the Gospel of Luke as we have dug in and thought deeply about these subjects. They challenge us. But at the end of it all, I pray that we would know beyond a shadow of a doubt that you care, that you love, and that you don't leave any of us hanging. And in the midst of the challenge and the difficulty, the struggle, the pain, the sorrow, you are there. You're doing something in and through us. I don't always have eyes to see, and I don't always have understanding and wisdom to know, but I believe this day that you are a God that will never let us go, and that you will complete the good work that you've started in us. Sometimes it's slow, sometimes it's fast, but I believe the promise of God says it will one day be complete. Thank you, Lord. Thank you that even when you ask of us difficult things, you empower us to accomplish them. Thank you that when even we fail, you have the love to lift us up. And when we hurt, you have the ability to ease that pain and bring about something redemptive. Thank you. I ask, Father, that you would keep my brothers and sisters strong, powerful, and mighty through this summer. And I pray that you would bring us back again in September to continue this journey that you brought us on. And for that now, I bless you. In Christ's precious name. Amen. Thank you so much, brothers and sisters, for your time. God bless you.
All right. We just have...